I'll be lost inside my head. Bad thoughts till 4 a.m. and I'll try to sleep. And I can't tell anyone. I'm so scared they'll get up and run, so I don't speak. And oh, I miss when we were younger. The days were so much funner, weren't they? Oh, I book a new appointment. It's another disappointment. They're all the same, same, same. When the doctor says I'm fine, one in the morning, one at night. These pills will help you remember how to smile. But what does he know? 'Cause I feel so alone. And mom and dad both tell me I'm alright. 'Cause the doctor said you're fine. Your mind can't lie to me. They'll say it's anxiety, but I just think it's me. Now I've lost so many years. My pillow's a tissue for my tears, but you never see. And now I can't even eat my dinner. Mom says I'm getting. Disappointment. They're all the same, same, same. When the doctor says I'm fine, one in the morning, one at night. These pills will help you remember how to smile.
And good morning. You are listening to Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBO Community Radio. I'm your host, Paul Rowland. I wanted to start out with that song, which I just found last night, which I think relates to what we're going to be talking about today, that she's 20, Chloe Adams, and she wrote that 2 years ago when she was 18. I find that rather remarkable. It's worth checking out, The Doctor Said, bit of a YouTube sensation. Anyway, we are going to be talking, this is our first Wednesday focus on mental health and mental liberation. And we're going to be talking about an inside deep look at the psychiatric survivors movement, which at least the modern iteration is 50 years strong. In fact, this year is the 50th anniversary of the creation of the Insane Liberation Front by three Portlanders. Oh my God, I had their names right here. Tom Wittick. And oh my God, I'll get that before too long. Anyway, they were three Portlanders who started the group here in Portland, the Insane Liberation Front, which was one of the kind of the front runners. It's actually almost like a mythical status, sort of. In the any history I read of the patients movement talks about that group as one of the first organized groups. Anyway, that's what we're gonna be talking about this morning for the next hour, and I've got three guests and a co-host in training with me, two in the studio, two on the phone. On the phone, I've got Laura Van Tosh from Seattle, founder of the Mental Health Policy Roundtable. In the studio, I've got Kevin Fitz, executive director of the Oregon Mental Health Consumers Association. Also on the phone, Rebecca Edens, president of the Oregon Consumer Psychiatric Survival Coalition. And also in the studio is Reggie Lee, who is with Rethinking Psychiatry, which is sponsoring the three aforementioned people, Laura, Kevin, and Becky, who are going to be at the first event of the season, the new season for Rethinking at the Montevilla United Methodist Church this evening at 7 p.m. That's 232 Southeast 80th Avenue here in Portland. So with that, let me just go around once more, and you'll familiarize with your voices here. So good morning, Laura, first of all.
Good morning.
So let me just introduce you a little more thoroughly. You're a peer, which is someone who works with people who are having emotional, mental, psychic distress or imbalance, however you want to talk about it, who has held policy positions at the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors, the University of Maryland, and the State of Oregon Health Authority. You're the founder of, as I said, a mental health policy roundtable that met in Washington, D.C. for 8 years and started a local version of the policy roundtable in King County, Washington. Without introducing you further and talking about this roundtable, maybe you could talk yourself about, I guess, a little bit about what you brought you to this work and what you're doing now with the roundtable.
Okay, well, thank you for hosting this show and involving everyone in the process. I became involved in the late 70s when I was institutionalized in Washington State as a patient at Western State Hospital. I came there basically against my will and voluntarily committed. And over the course of these decades now, I've experienced ups and downs in my life like everyone, but also ended up in and out of the hospital over, you know, many, many years. And over time, I realized that there really needs to be change in our system and the way we treat people who have mental health issues or mental health challenges. And so I became involved in the field first as a street outreach worker back in Philadelphia, and then later decided to get involved in making change through policy work and had the privilege of working with some of the best leaders in the field around how to engage people with mental health issues in making change, and also working with other stakeholders who have an interest in making improvements to the behavioral health care system. And so I created the Mental Health Policy Roundtable in the late 1990s as a way of bringing some of the experts in the field together with more new folks who are junior policy staff and younger people in the field who really didn't have a sense of the underpinnings of the processes in our field and the way policy is shaped. And so the roundtable brought these two different groups together to exchange ideas, to learn from each other, and to really help build up a new crew of people who can make change and shape policy in the behavioral healthcare environment. Now I'm back in Washington State, and we're kind of doing a junior policy roundtable. We had a session on inclusion. We were lucky enough to have a speaker from Pennsylvania come in and talk about that issue. Later on in the year, there'll be a roundtable on the Surgeon General's report on mental health, which is celebrating 20-year anniversary. First Surgeon General support ever, and only one so far on mental health. And we're also going to be having a roundtable with some state legislators before the end of the year as well. So anyhow, that's my contribution so far, is working on those issues and also helping other peers like myself get engaged in the legislative process in our state capital, Olympia. And there's a network called Peer Legislative Advocates that are helping to provide people with education so that they can lobby and advocate in Olympia and also make similar change at our state level.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to get a little deeper into the nitty-gritty and what you see some of the changes you're working towards, maybe some successes you've had, maybe some failures and frustrations, that sort of thing. But let me bring our other two guests. Let's continue with our other guest on the phone. Bring her in. That's Rebecca Edens, again, president of the Oregon Consumer Psychiatric Survivor Coalition, considers herself a mind freedom fighter. I'd like to hear more about that. Advocate, activist, and is committed to securing the human rights and cognitive liberty of people labeled, quote, mentally ill. I like that, cognitive liberty also. So, yeah, good morning, Rebecca, or Becky.
Good morning.
So,
can you hear me? I'm having a little connection problem.
No, that you just came in loud and clear. At first, you were a little faded. Now we hear you loud and clear. So, you talk a little bit about your journey and how it brought to the work that you're doing now.
Well, like many of us, my journey started with being hospitalized, oddly enough, like Laura in Washington State, back in the mid 80s. So I was hospitalized really against my will, and that's when I was first introduced to the idea that I didn't realize until that point that I thought I was an American citizen who had certain rights, and I found out the day that those doors shut and that they wouldn't let me out that I didn't have the same rights as other people once I was labeled with this mental health diagnosis. And so that started a journey during that hospitalization when I realized and made a promise to myself that if there was anything that I could do to change this oppressive system in which people were drugged against their will, that's what I would do. So that's sort of where my journey started.
And about how long ago was that?
That was in the mid-80s.
Okay.
And so, obviously, it started at that time in Washington State, and also there wasn't the internet, is that you were sort of alone in this thing. But like many of us, it was other people, other inmates on the unit that I got acquainted with, and we sort of supported each other once we got out of the psychiatric hospital, they called it, which was really like a prison, because it didn't take long to learn that unless you complied with their treatment, because they had so much power over you, that you would never get out. So after I got out, of course, I was on a lot of drugs, and back then those drugs were called Haldol and Stilazine and Thorazine and those kind of things, and it was really difficult to begin your life once you had been sort of brainwashed into and being told that you had this disease, that you'd have to take this medication for the rest of your life. And also it's sort of like it robbed any beauty and robbed my soul. It's like I couldn't even get to the part of myself. I didn't know my voice again. So over time, I went through a process of without support, because there wasn't a lot of support back there then, of having to withdraw from those medications and to go through that process. And then I think sometime around when I moved back to Oregon the late 90s, I sort of dropped into a drop-in center, which was actually founded because of some of Kevin's work and other great people in Oregon who started these drop-in centers across Oregon. And then I found out that there were hundreds, even thousands of people in this psychiatric survivor movement. And I met people like David Romfrey and David Oakes, and became a member of Mind Freedom. And so I wasn't alone anymore in this fight for liberation. And that started the process. And so I think probably since then, I've been working actively to try to, I've been involved at the state level with trying to get policies changed and legislation, but really a lot of my work has been through advocacy. I went to work at the Oregon State Hospital as an advocate.
And what does that entail?
Well, at the time, what that meant is that I was a recovery specialist or a peer support specialist. But there was a guy named David Romfrey, and he created a position called the Peer Bridger Project. But unfortunately, David died, and I went to work at the Oregon State Hospital. But before that, there was a guy named Gary Scholander, who went from being a patient at the Oregon State Hospital and a janitor in a basement at a day program to becoming one of the first advocates to work for Disability Rights Oregon at the time. And so I think it was over 30 years ago he went to work at the state hospital. So an advocate was someone that sort of came along patients alongside patients in their at their treatment team meetings. They're called IDTs, and was sort of a liaison between the patient and the psychiatrist in that group of people, so that people could have a voice in their own treatment. And unfortunately, all these many years later, it's still hard to get advocacy for patients in the Oregon State Hospital. So that's sort of where my work started, because of the fact that people, when they don't, when they're forced drugged and you don't have access always to your language and your voice, and there's forced, you're forced to comply to things that you don't want to do, or you'll never get out of the hospital.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that. And so in the studio, we have Kevin Fitz, who was just referred to by Becky. Talk about how you got to be what you're doing now.
So I think any brief bio should probably illustrate or say I grew up in a family with an extremely verbally and emotionally abusive alcoholic father, and a mother who was weakened by nerves and anxiety and intermittent Valium addiction. So I grew up, though, thankfully, with two blessed older sisters who cared for me and looked out for me, but with parents that were particularly struggling, emotionally unavailable, chaotic, and challenging.
Speak more into the mic.
Okay, and I came out of the womb 5 weeks too early. So highly nervous, highly sensitive. My radar was too long for the planet. So had a lot of issues around parents' divorce, alcoholism, abuse, bullying, daily. And then at 19, I was in Fort Lee, Virginia, United States Army training to be a cook. I ingested, unknown to me, a cigarette laced with phencyclidrine, or the street name is angel dust or PCP. Smoked that cigarette, and then within 6 hours became floridly psychotic. Went from normal sort of neurotic issues and trauma issues to 110% psychotic. I left and went AWOL from the United States Army in late April of 1984. Ended up here on the streets of Old Town. My middle sister took me in.
You were from Oregon originally.
Yeah, and so, and then I ended up in and out of the state institution, in the federal military institution in Fort Lewis, and back into community services in a few different places in Oregon. With the diagnosis of schizophrenia, you're going to live in this group home forever. You're unable to take care of yourself, and you need to understand, you need to accept the path in front of you.
That seems to be a common thread here. They
sure.
They seem to like to say that you're going to take this drug forever, that you're never going to get better.
Yeah, yeah. And met a man at one of the group homes I was getting kicked out of. I got kicked out of three or four of them because I was resistant and was not keen on authority. I'm an anarchist by nature. I don't trust authority. And the man who kicked me out was a gentleman who had previously been in the state hospital, previously had recovered and was recovering from alcoholism. He was involved in a community center on 26 in Southeast Belmont called the Mind Empowered, which was a drop-in center for mental health consumers, psychiatric survivors, and peers that was open 10 to 12 hours a day. From top to bottom, everyone who worked there had the experience of mental health issues.
How long did that run for?
Well, so that started in 1988 as a pilot project from the federal government, and then it lasted about till about 1995. five, and then some of the remnants of that were picked up by another community organization. But that was probably about 4 or 5 years. And this is pre-internet. And so it was a community of mental health consumers, psychiatric survivors running a community center with no musts, with no you have to affix this label to yourself, you have to repeat what the diagnostic manual says about you. And so since then, from then, in the early 90s, working at this community drop-in center run by mental health consumers and psych survivors, I got involved in the movement. And in 1991, I organized and was the chair of the organization that organized the National Psych Survivor Mental Health Consumer Conference in Berkeley, California in 1991. And that opened my eyes to people like David Oakes and Judy Chamberlain and the movement, that the liberation movement from this iatrogenic, damaging, traumatic system. And that changed my life and the direction of my life. And ever since then, more or less, I've been involved on grassroots activities, and particularly now, so in the last 15 years, very interested in the intersection of where does the money go, what does our county and our state government do with that money, and how do we change policy, law, and administrative rules to redirect that money to help people and not just fund the psychiatric industrial treatment complex.
And you are the executive director of the Oregon Mental Health Consumers Association. Did you talk about that?
So the Oregon Mental Health Consumers Association grew out of some previous work I was doing under state grant, and the essential goal was that if you are a person with a lived experience of a mental health diagnosis, that we want you to get involved in policy and bureaucratic discussions. And so a lot of what the work that I do now and have been doing is trying to make a seat at the table, a larger seat at the table, for people with lived experience to have a voice. The industry, the medical industry, the pharmaceutical industry, the bureaucrats, the mental health directors, they all have a tremendous amount of ability to stay at, to be at those tables. People who have the experience of mental health diagnoses and poverty and homelessness and other issues don't have that. And so what we try to do is look, I spend a lot of time looking at org charts and looking at state rule and state charter that's saying you need to have 51% of your board, 51% of your advisory committee populated by people who are mental health consumers and psychiatric survivors. And so that is the fight particularly. And then when I'm not doing that, I work on legislative activities to try to fund innovative stuff that is outside the dominant paradigm, like, for example, peer respite.
And the lived experience seems to be kind of a main catchword here for what we're talking about, which is the history of the patients or psychiatric survivors movement, from the first person and all three of our guests and, as I said, my co-host in training, Reggie. Good morning, Reggie.
Good morning.
who's here? We'll probably chime in as well. All had experience. I've had what I always say is a relatively brief but intense experience of my own. Just touched in with those powerful psychotropic drugs that I think all of our guests have talked about having been subjected to. Mine, in my case, wasn't forcibly. In any case, I've talked about that in the past. Don't need to go into that now. But the lived experience aspect is what I guess I'm pointing to. And again, tonight, you can hear much more at much greater depth and actually meet in person all the people, except Reggie, who will be at a volunteer orientation at KBOO tonight. But there's a history of the psychiatric survivors movement sponsored and put on by Rethinking Psychiatry at the Montville United Methodist Church at 7 o'clock this evening in Portland, 232 Southeast 80th Avenue. All that information and more is on my program page at kboo.org, Wednesday Talk Radio. So I have to say, I'm sure you all have read this long time ago, but I am in the middle of reading Anatomy of an Epidemic by Robert Whittaker. And as much as I, kind of thought I knew new about this stuff. It's blowing my mind. It's just an amazing story of how the pharmaceutical industry has gotten such immense power and control. And you know, I was talking, I guess I was talking with Kevin last night about you know, some of the famous muckraker books like Upton Sinclair, the Jungle, about the meatpacking industry, which, from what I understand, had a major impact, like almost right away. You know, congressional hearings and new laws. I mean, not single-handedly that book, but it had a huge influence. And obviously, it's a sign of the times, you know, I don't know what exactly, but you know, this book and books like it, books before it, have there ever been the kind of soul-searching, you know, shining the light on the industry? Has there ever been a time? I'll just throw that open, as people who have been at this for quite a long time. Has anything really changed? Maybe I'll just put that out to Laura, who spoke first.
Well, I certainly hope so. Thank goodness you have at least three people right now on the phone, on the show, that are surviving and thriving and helping other people. So I really do hope so. I did want to say one quick thing about lived experience and the term of art that's emerged. You know, I'm really focused too on prevention. And so not everybody has lived experience, you know, right now, but could. And so I really think that some of the services that Kevin and Becky and others are describing, are really helping people to sort of preempt entrance into, you know, a state hospital or entrance into a homeless shelter, and just supporting people so that they don't have to necessarily travel down that road. So I just wanted to add that. I do know that, you know, through the work of especially Kevin and myself and others that are now delving into legislative activity, that it's really through that process in many ways that we can, you know, on the books, make some systemic change. In Washington State, we're in the midst of a transformation, quote unquote, of our system, but we're also finding ourselves developing more hospital beds and other things that, you know, really sort of go against the grain of recovery. So we're now in the midst of sort of fighting an old fight, and trying to develop alternatives and support people to, again, divert themselves from state hospital systems or public mental health systems. And I do want to just add, there's so much to talk about, I realize that we have a huge number of people in jail, that, you know, for just in terms of that environment, that there's really very little or no help for people that are incarcerated in our city and county jails and prison. And I know that there's effort now to divert those folks into treatment rather than languish in jail where there's, you know, there's really no door open.
How about peer support in the prisons? Do you know much about any programs like that?
Well, there are now people who are peer support forensic workers. Not a great title, but something to that effect, where people are going inside the jails and prison as well, to support people who are there and to help people bridge out to the community or out to community-based inpatient hospitals and so forth. That's a new area. But actually in Georgia, there are a number of people who have previous forensic or criminal history that are now working to support people to get out of those systems and back to the community or to other services. Mm-hmm. And I know in Washington, we're going to be hiring through a state court settlement, a case called True Blood. There will be a group of people hired with lived experience, as we're calling it, to work in jails and so forth to help people come out of those environments. So I know in Washington they'll be brand new, but we're hopeful that we can get a group of people hired to do that.
Mm-hmm. Once again, this is Wednesday Talk Radio. I've got three guests who are going to be speaking again this evening at the Montville United Methodist Church, where you can get to meet them and hear more about their stories and about the history of the psychiatric survivors movement. And it is a call-in show as well. The number, if you don't know it already, is 503-231-8187. I've got one of the lines is occupied by my guest, but there is one line open, so you may have to wait to get through. But 503-231-8187. If you yourself have a, as we're calling it, lived experience, whatever that might mean for you, if you consider yourself a psychiatric survivor. I guess we're all psychiatric survivors living in an insane society, as it were. But please call in and ask your question or say what you have to say. And let me throw that open the question to Becky and Kevin about how things have changed just say in your time since whatever the 1980s. If I guess my question was in context of Anatomy of Epidemic, which is basically the extreme prevalence and preference for powerful psychiatric drugs for supposedly resolving people's problems, and that is the dominant, the medical model, as it's called, the dominant paradigm for dealing with a wide range of issues that we all face, and some people face in a more extreme or intense way, or maybe they're just in the wrong place at the wrong time, or maybe they're just confused. Becky, have you seen things change or in any way in terms of that, and in making some sort of incremental progress towards treating people more humanely in the system? Becky, are you still with us?
Yes, I'm here. Well, I'd like to say that I'd like to say that there's been change. There's been some change, but I guess not enough change. And I think that what still happens is that we go out there and we say sometimes that we want people to have access to treatment, but the problem is that when the when they get into the door of treatment, underlining all the beautiful words about person-centered and all that sort of stuff is always sort of the needle or the pill. It's sort of like in Oregon. Oregonians go, especially people with public mental health, and they go to see a therapist. But often, first they see a prescriber. So what they do is they don't have real alternatives, choices other than medication available to people. It's sort of like, well, take the pill and then go to an exercise class. You know, you're still taking the pill, which has huge body damaging and mind damaging effects on an individual. I've actually seen things go backwards at the Oregon State Hospital. In 2006, when Oregon was being sued, they talked about recovery. They instituted all these innovative practices that they said that they were going to do in regards to a recovery-oriented system of care. But the problem is that when the lawsuit was settled, they started returning back to those restrictive force, risk assessment sort of start programs, in which underlying everything is this idea of the diagnosis. An example is that people really are over-medicated at the Oregon State Hospital to control the milieu, not to treat the person. The idea that individualized treatment happens almost anywhere is not true. there's a lot of pharmaceutical intervention, but actually being able to talk to an individual about the human distress that got you there in the first place doesn't really happen. They always talk about getting people out of the jails and opening up beds at the Oregon State Hospital through Aid and Assist, but the issue is that when people really get to the Oregon State Hospital, they get very little individualized treatment. They go to a treatment mall, they see their prescriber, you know, it's all about the medication controlling the behaviors instead of people actually having alternatives. In Europe, they have actual wards in which people have an option to not take medication. Sort of what we did is that we do have peer support today, which is great, you know, on the preventative level. But what we're doing is still providing a lot of support for people to recover from their experience of being psychiatrized. So this idea of creating alternatives to the traditional mental health system is really important because people really need another option besides just a pill. That's not necessarily the answer. So when I talk about cognitive liberty, you know, it's like just the fact of being drugged because they say that you have a choice, but you don't really have a choice when the choice is between mustard and mustard, you know. An example is somebody, like I said, who goes to get treatment, but they get a pill first. So it's sort of always underlying treatment is this idea of putting somebody on a medication and keeping them on that medication for the rest of their lives.
And again,
so I actually don't see it getting better. I actually see it going backwards.
And I'm sure
And I have firsthand experience having worked at the Oregon State Hospital and still advocating for people that are really housed there. So, and now we're doing it in the community in the form of assertive community treatment in which people are offered services, but it's strongly suggested that they have to stay on this medication regime in order to recover. So I actually don't see it getting better. It's just sort of a revolving door.
Okay. I think this, I can't recommend this book enough, Anatomy of an Epidemic by Robert Whitaker, and maybe other people have other resources they want to refer to. I want to hear from Kevin, but we have our first caller, so I'm going to go to Joanne. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm a low-income person, and I got a couple of new disabilities, tinnitus in my ear and that. Anyway, I have the booklet in front of me. I attended that Rethinking Psychiatry there at the First Unitarian Church 2011, but I was never able to connect with anybody, and in the meantime, I've gotten threatened with eviction and a whole bunch of, I can't get good mental health care. Cascadia is poor quality. So anyway, another big thing, everybody uses computers and I don't, and cell phones. So, and I also was a member of Mind Freedom, but I don't have any contact with them anymore. I don't know what's happened to them. But anyway, what I want to find out for my needs, since I have all these other low-income problems, so I don't end up again or end up in a mental hospital, what is the meeting? Where is the meeting? And please say it slowly. The meeting today, and how can I connect with the national organization? Because I'm going to go down soon with Donald Trump and the government that and what he's doing. I'm going to end out on the street again or in one of his camps. Okay, go ahead. I'll listen.
Okay, thank you, Joanne. I'll toss that to Kevin. But the event is this evening. At 7 o'clock in the evening at the Montevilla United Methodist Church, and that's 232 Southeast 80th Avenue. And that's right off the, you know, there's the 20 bus and the 15 bus go right near there.
Did you say it was a Baptist?
No, church? United Methodist.
Community myth is Montevideo. Yeah, you.
Okay.
Okay. And does anybody know about Mind Freedom? What's happened to Mind Freedom in Eugene?
I think Becky is involved with them, so I'll throw that. Well, thank you for calling, Joanne. Appreciate it. Becky, what's going on with Mind Freedom?
Well, great things are going on with Mind Freedom. And I'm sorry, what was the caller's first name?
Joanne.
Joanne. Yeah, Joanne brought up a point that is really important to me, is that a lot of what happens today is, you have to have access to internet and, to kind of get some of this information. So Mind Freedom actually is doing if anybody wants to go to, they can go look up Mind Freedom. I think it's mindfreedom.org. And there's all kinds of information about there about how to get involved. The Mind Freedom Shield was published recently, in which people can download this information and they can read about how to get involved with Mind Freedom. And there's a lot of information.
Of course,
on
that doesn't
their, website.
That doesn't help Joanne because she's not on the computer.
No, it doesn't. And so what I was going to do to talk about Joanne, if she's still listening, she can call me. I'll talk to people on the phone. It doesn't mean that I'll necessarily be able to help them with their specific problem, but I don't have any problem giving out my phone number. It's out there on the internet. So here it goes. It's 503-812-9636. And I'd be glad to have a conversation with her if she wanted to call me and try to connect her with some people. There are consumer-run organizations around and people that can maybe help her to navigate through this process. But that's 503-812-9636. And Joanne, I'd be glad to have a conversation with you.
Okay, 812-9636. Let me throw the question, the previous question, and this one over to Kevin.
Your point about the anatomy of an epidemic by Robert Whitaker, I did two books that were preeminent in shaping my understanding of this. Well, I should also mention Thomas Zaws, who wrote The Myth of the Mental Illness, and an awful lot of other books about forced psychiatric treatment, cognitive liberty, which is a particularly, and also civil rights, just amazing work. Anything by him, Thomas Zaws, having to do with mental health issues or psychiatry, fascinating. R.D. Lang also was an early pioneer in sort of inventing or looking at different ideas of what so-called therapeutic engagement looked like, which also was very important. Two books, Toxic Psychiatry, which came out in the early mid-80s by Peter Bragan, was probably, you know, the was another amazing book in our movement and amongst our people. And the book even before that was written in the late 1970s by probably the godmother or the founding matriarch of what we think of the psychiatric survivor movement, called On Our Own by Judy Chamberlain. One of the things that we lose, and our previous caller Joanne lamented it, community, in-person tribal community has shrunken. Newspapers have shrunken, flyers have shrunken, radio shows, broadcast radio shows, and their audience has shrunken. And we've moved into the digital soup. One of the only thing that I think, and it is also I criticize our movement, we have failed in, we do an amazing amount of criticism of the dominant system and its iatrogenic damages to our body and our minds. But we have failed and not adequately done an acceptable job of promoting, building, creating, developing, and running alternatives to the dominant paradigm. We rail, folks like us will be at the American Psychiatric Association this year protesting. We'll be in front of electroshock manufacturers protesting. We'll be at county and state legislators and commissions protesting and talking about bad treatment and wasted funds. We more so also need to put energy into investing into what is our underground railroad. We can liberate you from the state hospital system, but if we don't have anything that's going to help you with your wound or your pain, then where are we? Then we're lost.
Well, we don't exactly have an alternative to the capitalist system up and running, do we?
We don't. We don't. One other book I also want to say that I think is also preeminent. She wrote Sexual Politics, a woman named Kate Millett. Her second book was called The Loony Bin Trip. And if I recommend, if you have a friend, a wife, or a husband, or a son who's gone through severe mental health challenges and you've contemplated committing them or having them locked against their will and forcibly treated, The Loony Bin Trip lays out how that damages emotional connections, intellectual curiosity, and openness. You want to seal off your person's wound and pain, follow them through the process of being civilly committed against their will for what's best for them. The Loony Bin Trip, although written again in the late 70s, really illuminates that struggle of, I'm a human being, I'm an adult, I have rights, you're pathologizing and diseasing me, and then stepping into my brain to reorganize my chemicals without my consent.
Well, you know, I think a lot of people still probably have the idea that that's kind of in the past, you know, because, you know, one flew over the cuckoo's nest, that doesn't really happen anymore. You know, they shut down the big mental institutions. Of course, that's not, first of all, entirely true, but I think what you're pointing to is it has maybe shifted a little bit in that, you know, what happens is people get, you know, committed, and then they may not get locked up for 20 years, but they may get their minds locked up by getting on this drug regime, exclusively this drug regime, which then is its own kind of prison. I think that's what the, you know, people think that the, you know, I heard on AM right wing talk radio. I read about this actually in that other book that I was read recently. Madness is Civilization, so another really excellent book, which talked about the whole era of the shutdown of the many of the large kind of state run mental institutions that so featured in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest here in Oregon. Now like liberals are being accused of having shut them down because they wanted people to be free, and that's what led to this the houseless epidemic. That's like what now one of the talking points of the right wing is that you know, that's what the cause of homelessness is, all the do-gooders. Of course, the story is very different, and part of it is the pharmaceutical industries, you know, being able to, the pill solution is one of the main things that led to that, because people could sort of barely eke by on an exclusive. And of course, none of us are against taking, you know, certain medications at a certain point in time as a useful thing, or even as a long-term maintenance thing. Nobody's condemning anyone or saying, but we are saying that there is a reason why that is sort of the exclusive domain. Anyway, go ahead, Kevin.
Well, you bring up some interesting points about informed consent, but one of the things I want to push back on, and Becky also talked about it, We are now, and the winds have been at our back now for the last 8 or 10 years, the cry for greater, more institutions, more locked facilities. In Oregon, we have a 1,000-person hospital in Salem. We are planning to develop more and more secure residential treatment facilities. The public wants us to be in hospital cells.
So now it's going even back in that direction.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's, and you mentioned liberals, and I think that's a dirty word, because it smacks of corporatism and sellout and compromise. Some of the people who I think are the most, who call themselves the most liberal, are leading the charge to take away my civil rights and my cognitive liberties because they're uncomfortable with my negative emotionality. People are afraid of negative emotionality, and they'd rather pave you over and stuff you and have you be silent than exhibit negative emotionality at their tamped down, neurotic, picnic or barbecue.
It's called conflict aversion is right. Another word for that.
Yeah. We don't have freak out rooms anymore, and it's not cool to freak out. When was the last time you saw an Instagram that got a lot of likes of a person actually losing their marbles or going off the deep end? Exhibiting freaking out is diseased, is pathologized. It's not the image that we want to present.
We used to have primal scream therapy.
I know. Yeah.
Reggie wants to chime in. Go ahead, Reggie.
I just wanted to voice that most, or at least in my experience, most people that experience altered states of consciousness often have the idea that there's some merit to the experience and that there's something rich about it. And then the psychiatric system says the opposite. So there's this underlying argument that there's no validity to having this voice hearing experience. There's no there's nothing good and inherent in it. So I just wanted to kind of throw that out there that the psychiatric system just wants to pathologize it and put it in a box.
And again, this book has really opened my eyes to that, where he talks, Robert Whitaker, Anatomy of an Epidemic, where he talks about actual studies that compare how various forms of, now they're they've been diagnosed as different things like schizophrenia, bipolar, whatever, but had people suffering from some form of whatever, disequilibrium or intense experience, that they actually compared the people who were given drugs with before drugs were even utilized, and people actually naturally went through those processes. It was actually, it's theorized that there's some evolutionary value to having those kind of intense experiences. They're a reaction to a stressful situation that allows you to undergo it and go through it. The point is going through it, whereas a lot of these powerful drugs don't allow you to actually go through it. Anyway, just want to, but I guess we got a caller on the line. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey, Paul, how are you?
Good.
Hi, so nice to hear you back. All right, so as you know, I'm an old guy, and I was from an extended family. And one of my cousins that I was raised with was diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic. And back in those days, the therapy that they used was called electroshock therapy. He would have an episode, go to the hospital, they'd fry his brain and keep him there for a little while, and then kick him back out. So my question is, your thoughts about, I heard electric shock therapy is making a comeback, and so I wanted to know what you folks thought about it. And thank you so much for the show. Have a good day.
Okay. Well, let me just throw that out to anyone who wants to take it on.
Hi, this is Becky. Earlier I heard, you mentioned the fact that people think that one flew over the cuckoo's nest doesn't exist anymore, and the Oregon Psychiatric Survivor Coalition, with the support of Mind Freedom and the National Coalition for Mental Health Recovery, one of our strategic plans was to fly back to the cuckoo's nest with this idea of liberation. And I've got to tell you that people think that ECT, electroshock therapy, doesn't happen anymore, but it does. And it happens, it's farmed out now at the Oregon State Hospital. There is a resurgence of ECT and other forms of sort of electroshock therapy. So it still does happen. That's not to say that some people...
Oh, we lost you in mid-sentence.
I'm not saying that some people haven't found some benefit from it, but it goes back to informed choice about the process, because what ECT really is it induces traumatic brain injury to people, and there's long-term effects that people aren't told about, and so it happens all the time till today. And I would encourage people to go to that mindfreedom.org website And also there's Mad in America. And you can go to the Foundation of Excellence, and they have a lot of good articles to read. But I would encourage all Oregonians to think about this idea of getting involved against psychiatric oppression. I think even psychiatrists should be concerned about the oppressive practices that they do.
Especially but they should.
Electroshock is alive and well.
We only have a couple minutes left. I think there's also a site, ECT Freedom. I've had Deborah on, who's an activist against ECT. I believe that's the website. But we got to wrap this up real soon. Laura, any last thoughts before we see you this evening at the Montevilla United Methodist Church?
Well, I'm just grateful that Rethinking Psychiatry exists and is having our panel. I do want to emphasize that beyond all the books that were mentioned, that we should not forget that we should be talking with people who are serving or people that are not being served so that we can really develop whatever's needed so folks can be in the community outside of institutions. Thanks for having this show.
Okay. And Kevin?
Yeah, I just want to say thank you so much, Paul, for inviting us on and have us discuss this topic. I just want to spell my last name because there's probably nobody who has a larger network up and down the Northwest part of the United States than I do. And so if you're interested in getting involved or learning about what's up, my last name is Fitz, F-I-T-T-S, and I'm all over social media. Kevin Fitz, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter. And so I'd love to help cross-network folks that are interested in manning the revolution.
Personing, as it were. Okay.
Personing.
And thank you, Reggie, for stepping in again. And we'll be talking, you'll be involved more and more as we go along.
Thanks for having me.
And again, tonight at the Montevilla United Methodist Church, 232 Southeast 80th Avenue, 7 p.m., you can hear Laura, Becky, and Kevin and meet them to talk about the history of the psychiatric survivors movement. This is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Paul.
I'll be lost inside my head, bad thoughts till 4 a.m. and I'll try to sleep. And I can't tell anyone, I'm so scared they'll get up and run, so I don't speak. And oh, I miss when we were younger, the days were so much funner, weren't they? Oh, I book a new appointment, it's another disappointment. They're all the same, same, same. When the doctor says I'm fine, one in morning, one at night, these pills will help you remember how to smile. I feel so alone, and mom and dad both tell me I'm alright, 'cause the doctor said you're fine. My own mind can't lie to me, they'll say it's anxiety, but I just think it's me. Now I've lost so many years, my pillows and tissue for my tears, but you never see. And now I can't even eat my dinner, mom says I'm getting thinner. Am I? Oh, I book a new appointment, yet another disappointment. They're all the same, same, same. When the doctor says I'm fine, one in morning, one at night, these pills will help you remember how to smile. But what does he know? 'Cause I feel so alone, and mom and dad